Working in the emergency rooms of a level one trauma center is as frontline as it gets when it comes to seeing the horrors of gun violence. And in Cleveland, doctors, nurses, and staff see the horrific impact of gun violence on the body, and oftentimes young bodies. It takes a mental toll, especially with levels of gun violence only increasing since the pandemic began. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll talk to IdeaStream reporter Taylor Wisner, who spent a night in the Metro Health ER seeing firsthand what it takes to treat victims of violence. We'll also talk to the head of the ER department there and a trauma expert about how these doctors and staff cope. Later in the show, we'll learn about all the holiday arts events happening around Northeast Ohio. So if you're looking for a fun event to attend, stay tuned. First, the latest news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for joining us this morning. Since the pandemic, gun violence has risen across the country, especially in bigger cities. In Cleveland, since 2020, the number of homicides have been at least 130 per year. And as of mid-November this year, that number has reached 146. When someone has a gun-related injury, they're taken to a trauma center to receive the first level of emergency treatment. If that patient stays at the hospital for 25 days or more, they will be touched by about 400 to 500 people, including ICU nurses, to social workers, to radiologists, and cleaning staff. As gun violence and deaths from gunshot wounds rise, studies show trauma staff have high rates of anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder due to their jobs. A new story from IdeaStream Public Media looked into what it's like for hospital workers who are witnessing the aftermath of gun violence in our region. Joining me in studio is IdeaStream's health reporter, Taylor Wisner, who spent a night in Metro Health's ER reporting on this story. Taylor, thanks so much for being here this morning and braving the snow.
Yeah, this wintry morning. I'm happy to have made it safely.
Great, and great reporting. Also with us by phone is Dr. Jeffrey Claridge, the trauma director at Metro Health, who was featured in Taylor's reporting. Dr. Claridge, thanks so much for calling in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We also have Dr. Jennifer King, the co-director of the Center on Trauma and Adversity at Case Western Reserve University, who is also featured in Taylor's story. Dr. King, thanks so much for joining us by phone.
Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like to join the conversation or have a question, call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or you can tweet us. We are at Sound of Ideas. So, Taylor, I'd like to start with you. Tell us the process of reporting on this story, and where'd you get the idea to look into this population that we might not always think about when we're talking about the front lines of victim care?
Yeah. Well, my story was really centered on Metro Health's emergency room, where I spent a shift to see sort of the impact of gun violence on the healthcare workers that take care of people with gunshot injuries. And sort of the idea for that sort of came from something we sort of decided needed closer attention here at IdeaStream Public Media, which is the increase in gun violence in our community. And I think this came to a lot of people's attention this summer when we saw a couple high-profile incidents, you know, in the greater Cleveland area. And so we wanted to dive into the numbers and see what the actual increases were. And so we've covered that story. We're going to continue to cover it in a couple different community angles. But, you know, one thing that kept coming up when we were talking to people in the community is, you know, with all this violence, we would be in such a worse place if not for the incredible medical centers that the two trauma one centers in our community that do such a good job of taking care of people. And you know, we wanted to tell that story. And then as I talked to Dr. Claridge and other experts. You know, he was telling me how many people really are involved in that care. And then my supervisor, Marlene Harris Taylor, shout out, you know, had come up with this idea of, yeah, you know, one person we don't hear much is the cleaning staff, the people who, you know, who get into that grime and really have to quickly clean it in order for it to be safe for the next patient to come in, which they come in very quickly, as I learned, in that ER. So that's really what the impetus was for that that angle on the reporting.
And Dr. Claridge, you are featured in the story. You run one of Cleveland's level one trauma centers that Taylor's talking about, which means that you're treating the most seriously injured patients. I'm curious, we talk about these levels of gun violence increasing across the nation here in Cleveland. How much of an increase in gun violence injuries have you seen over the past few years? And it's my understanding that some of the injuries and the scope of the wounds have even gotten worse as well.
Yeah, so, you know, there was a period of time and, you know, two things happened at the same time, which cut, you know, a huge strain on the healthcare system. And at the same time, there was another pandemic going on, which was gun violence. And in 2020, we saw a huge spike that started across the nation and in Cleveland, notably as well. Of increasing gun violence, and it's, as I've told Taylor, it's just been sustained. It's non-relenting. Even I looked at my pager yesterday, and yesterday was a cold day, and we still had two gunshot wounds early in the morning yesterday morning. So it just has kind of continued since then, and we don't see a pause in the gun violence. We see multiple victims at the same times, and obviously, you know, mass shootings is a concern we all have now.
Dr. Claridge, the American College of Emergency Physicians says emergency doctors are more than twice as likely as the average person to experience PTSD from what they see at work. Is this something that the individuals like you and other doctors are aware of that comes with the territory? Or do you think that higher level of increased intensity of the injuries makes this a different environment? How do you cope?
Compartmentalization, probably not in healthy fashions. I would have to say, you know, the one thing that I pride ourselves on is I think we have a fantastic team, and really I've been able to assemble a team of healthcare providers that just does a fantastic job. And one of the things I was talking to Taylor about in the report is, you know, people who don't get attention in the front line. And it's not just the docs and the nurses, it's the number of people that touch a person when they come in. And I talked about the cleaning has to come in and, you know, several hundred hands will touch one patient, even if they're there for emergency. It's amazing, you know, lab and the cleaning crew. But I will have to tell you, I think on the physician side and the nursing side, we're not the best at taking care of ourselves, and I think it does have a toll, whether it's PTSD or it's burnout or it's, you know, it impinges on our morality. So I think that has a long-standing tradition, but it's gotten worse, and I don't think that we're always the healthiest if taking care of ourselves. So I think that's an issue that does need to be addressed. Some people cope with it better than others, but it does take a toll when it's day after day after day. And that's why you see a lot of people leave those, you know, you see nurses leave those acute areas and they go and work in the clinic. And I think some of that has to do with burnout and just the pace.
Sure. Those are some important points that you make. Jennifer, as a trauma expert, can you tell us more about what happens mentally and emotionally when people in the hospital setting work on these traumatic cases, such as gun violence injuries? And as Dr. Claridge pointed out, you know, we're talking about all sorts of staff members here, from the cleaning staff to the doctors. I mean, to see that type of intensity and horror is really something that's not easily shakable.
Of course, right. And I mean, we can't expect folks to be bearing witness to tragedy all day, every day, without being impacted by it. We think about secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, and primary trauma as being sort of occupational hazards for folks who are in helping professions. And I think, like Dr. Claridge was speaking to, while the doctors and nurses and other folks who are engaging with patients as they're coming in crisis, they might experience that as sort of a primary traumatic experience. Folks like cleaning staff who may not see the person upon arrival, but then are tasked, you know, with this really sort of graphic experience of having to clean up the fluids and all of those other things. While they are not witnessing what happened to that person, in witnessing the aftermath, we tend to see some impacts on all sorts of areas of life. That's when we think about secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, which looks a lot like post-traumatic stress disorder, the difference being the traumatic experience is somebody else's, and I am instead sort of bearing witness to it or learning about it in a different sort of way. So the impact of trauma on sort of the broader team, I think, would affect each person differently, but absolutely contributes to burnout, to morale, to taking more time off, more sick days, and ultimately can impact the quality of care that's provided to patients if there's not awareness around it, support around it, and really intention around mitigating some of these impacts.
Yeah, because I got to assume that for doctors, nurses, staff to best treat their patients, you know, they have to have great footing and not feel, you know, distraught and have PTSD and those types of things. So that's a really important point. Taylor, you found in your reporting that there's been a major increase in how many gunshot patients are being treated now versus a decade ago. Give us some of those numbers, because I was really shocked by what I saw.
Yeah. So we have a regional trauma collaboration here in Northeast Ohio called NOTS, or Northern Ohio Trauma System. They release an annual report every year looking at the patients that come through the emergency departments, and looking 10 years ago, comparing numbers. In 2021, they treated about 1,200 gunshot patients. That was sort of the most recent report we have to compare. And then looking 10 years earlier, 2011, the system saw half as many of those patients with gunshot injuries, around 550 patients. So that's quite a jump there. And then in addition to that, I think you sort of mentioned earlier, Jenny, but the mortality rates for gunshot wound victims are also rising. Dr. Claridge explained to me that is likely due in part to people coming in with more bullet wounds.
Yeah. Wow. Taylor, you focus your reporting, as we've talked about, not just on the doctors, but non-healthcare workers impacted by gun violence. I know that you spoke to a member of the cleaning staff who may not have a lot of information before he gets into a room that he has to clean. Can you tell us about one worker you spoke to, Stolly Johnson?
Yeah, yes. I talked with, several people, several cleaners in my one shift I was shadowing in the ER. And Stolly was this wonderful guy. He's a 40-year-old Liberian immigrant. He has a strong Liberian accent, so I'm just going to let listeners know. You might have to listen a little more closely, but you can, hear him say for himself, what it's like for him to go into the rooms that he's tasked with cleaning, many, sometimes filled with blood, and he doesn't know the full story.
I feel so bad. Actually, I feel bad. I feel for the family. Probably the person had a kid and other things. I don't know what happened. I have no idea. But because we are human, so like the sorrow came to me, see a young man lying down and he's gone.
Yeah. I mean, you can just hear kind of the pain of knowing the loss that took place in that room. I will say, too, I mean, Johnson and the other cleaners are, you know, consummate professionals. You know, they say that they do this job every day, and Johnson, you know, was sort of telling me he's not really affected too badly. I mean, he feels for the patients, but he's able to do his work and to show up every day with a smile on his face and be there, as he explained to me also, because he has to sort of present sort of a warm demeanor for the patients and their families. If you can think about, you know, people coming into those rooms sort of at the worst moments maybe in their lives.
Sure.
And they see, you know, part of their job as being there to support those families. So he's having to carry sort of the emotional burden of other people as well as his own, you know, feelings of walking into a room and not knowing sort of the full story, but having to clean anyways.
Yeah, it's so interesting to talk about whether the cleaning staff has the context of understanding why they see so much blood and so much of the kind of, you know, physical aftermath of a case that's been worked on. Taylor, you also spoke with Marcia Emerson, an environmental services manager at the hospital, about what it must be like for individuals like Johnson who don't have a lot of that context and information about the gun violence incident before they're asked to clean up a room.
Yeah. Well, I'll let her speak for herself. Let's play a clip from her.
We do talk to them about it. You know, hey, you know, it is part of our responsibility to get in there. You know, if we do see family members outside, they may say, you know, it's going to be okay. I mean, it is part of our job to interact with patients and family members. Unfortunately, in this case, there is no one. But it is hard for them to see stuff like that on a daily basis. And we do allow them time to debrief and to give us feedback as to, you know, how they're feeling and, you know, how best we can support them. And we do have quite a lot of programs here that, you know, support them.
So, Dr. Claridge, in hearing Stolle talk about his impressions after seeing the person on the gurney, I don't know, what kind of impact does that have on you? And also, what kind of support does MetroHealth have for workers like that who might feel anxiety, depression, or PTSD from working in the trauma center?
Yeah, so first and foremost, I can't thank our environmental services enough at Metro, and I'm so happy that Taylor ran with this story. When we were kind of talking about it this summer, we were talking about the real unsung heroes, and I'm like, I don't realize the amount of hours that we spend when everybody else is sleeping or on holiday. That's when we're at our busiest.
Sure.
And to hear him tell the story of how gut-wrenching it is, you know, you can tell he's doing his job, he does it well, but there's a person and a family. Everyone who we lose has a family. And you can tell that that's hard on them. They do a fantastic job. We have a lot of services for that. Obviously, the team is the first most important thing. We try to do a moment of silence in the room when we pronounce someone, and we ask if anyone has any questions. I think that was something we started probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I think that it means a lot. So we make sure if anyone has any questions, who took care of the patient that was in the room, we try to leave that open for that, and we try to make sure we honor that patient and family in the moment. So I think that's something we started doing. We've had major debriefings and meetings of serious natures. When you see something that's really tragic, we've actually brought the hospital together occasionally. Dr. Bob Smith is there as a resource for us and has helped my team kind of work through these things. And we have, you know, MetroHealth has services with EAP that can kind of the employee assistant program that we send people to as well. So I think that's really important. And I would say people need to make sure they know when they're not doing well and seek help.
Taylor, I know that you...
We've lost a few people over the years too. No, I was just saying we've had a few people who've had to leave the profession over the years because it's been so trying. So it's just sad to see.
Yeah, the strain must be enormous emotionally and physically of jobs like that. Taylor, you said that Stolle himself hasn't used counseling at MetroHealth, but the job has impacted his personal behaviors outside of the hospital.
Yeah. As I sort of mentioned, you know, he doesn't see himself as someone who's really struggling with what he sees. He says he's able to keep work and home separate. But that said, you know, he knowing sort of all the gun violence and sort of getting a sense of where it's happening in the community has made him more vigilant. He tells me when he hears about, you know, shooting at some place that he goes, like a grocery store near work, he's not going to go there anymore. And he talks with his girlfriend about this all the time. They try and avoid going out at night.
Yeah.
You know, they really kind of, as he said, sort of like slows down his movements. Like he's really more careful about where he goes, and that he really needs to be there. When it's a time that there may be more shootings, like late at night. So, it follows people home as the best, you know, all of our work follows us home, you know, as best as we can to keep that separate. And sort of doing this kind of work, I'm sure, you know, even the, you know, most careful person who gets all the help they can, who's really, you know, pays attention to themselves, still has to carry these burdens, and they follow them. Yeah.
Jennifer, we have about a minute left. I apologize for that, but I'd love to hear you, give us some of the resources that are available for staff members at Metro Health and others that are working in emergency rooms. How can they work to alleviate some of the stresses of this job?
Sure. So I think awareness is really important because, like in the example that you just gave, Taylor, if you don't have an understanding of the potential ways that this type of work can impact you, you can come to the conclusion that there is something wrong with you, that you're not capable of performing the task at hand, that you need to switch jobs, things like that. So whether it's training or just some sort of psychoeducation around the realities of secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, burnout, all of those sorts of things. Like Dr. Claridge mentioned, you know, EAPs and counseling can be really helpful. Debriefing, especially in peer groups, can be really helpful. But also, I just encourage folks to think about the ways that they might be able to sort of metabolize what they've taken in over the course of a day. And while that might look like counseling or therapy, it might also look like spiritual practices or physical outlets or creative expression. And also, really wanting to underscore the importance of community. So being able to turn toward colleagues, toward family, toward other supports to sort of help to bolster you if you're having some of these negative experiences due to the work that you probably really care about and want to do really well.
Some great points. Dr. Jennifer King, co-director of the Center on Trauma and Adversity at Case Western Reserve University, Dr. Jeffrey Claridge, trauma director at Metro Health, and our own health reporter, Taylor Wisner. I appreciate all of you joining me this morning for an important conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And you can find Taylor Wisner's story on ideastream.org or by going to our show page, ideastream.org/SOI. You're with the Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. We are in the middle of the busy holiday season, which means there's plenty of things to do in and around Northeast Ohio from now until the end of the year. IdeaStream's Kabir Bhatia joined me earlier this month to look at all of the arts and culture offerings in the region. Kabir, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Jenny. Of course, I have to say this is not all the offerings in Northeast Ohio, or we would be here until All Things Considered starts tomorrow. There's a lot.
Good point. Yes. So then what are we talking about?
So we're going to talk about all sorts of just some highlights. I've kind of scoured our listening area to see what we've got exactly. So let me ask you something. What did you do over the Thanksgiving weekend?
We had Thanksgiving. And then we brought out our decorations for Christmas. Now, we haven't gotten them up, but that's pretty much the start.
So you were kind of around the house.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. A lot of folks, though, this time of year do not want to be in the house. People want to get out. So we had Thanksgiving. We had Diwali at my house. That's two big winter holidays that are already in the books. So just coming up in the next few weeks, we've got Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa, Boxing Day, Festivus, New Year's. It is Raven Simone's birthday. This month is going to be so Raven. So I... looked
so
all,
Raven.
I looked all throughout this area. You know how big this area is, our listing area.
22 counties.
Exactly. See, this is why you're the new host. So within that 22 counties, there's plenty going on. And there's, all, of course, a lot of great traditions that we have. Castle Noel in Medina. There's the Cuyahoga Valley Scenic Railroad. You can take a lantern tour at Hale Farm. There's Christmas in Zora, the Deck the Hall celebration at Stan Hewitt Hall and Gardens. There's a lot. And then there is Glow at the Cleveland Botanical Garden. You've probably heard of that, or maybe last year you heard about Twinkle in the 216.
I've definitely heard Twinkle in the 216.
So both of those now, those names have been replaced with a new experience called Frost, an ice-capped garden experience. And they're going to be using all sorts of lights and flower installations, and they'll kind of transform the inside and the outside of the gardens into this winter frost wonderland. And some of the areas, they have names like the Jingle Jungle or the Lake Effect Lodge, things like that.
I like that, Lake Effect Lodge. Now, will they still have the gingerbread houses and the Christmas trees?
Yes, of course. They've got to have those things. Those are still going to be there, decorated in all sorts of themes by people from throughout Northeast Ohio, and I'm excited to go see those. But as I'm looking at the photos, it reminded me there are a lot of light displays at different spots throughout the area. So there's wild lights at the Akron Zoo, wild winter lights at the Cleveland Zoo. I guess one is more winterly than the other. They're both both good, though. I've been to both. And if you don't want to get out of your car, there's something called Lights on the Lake in Lorain. And
a lot of alliteration.
Yeah, imagine Tom Brokaw saying that. That's at Lakeview Park, and it runs till 9 p.m. throughout the month. And if you check their website, there are even certain nights that you can register, and then you'd have to get out of your car to meet Santa.
Now, that sounds like a lot of fun. Isn't there something similar happening in East Cleveland?
Every year, yes. They have that just over the border from Coventry in the lighting display at Neela Park, which was owned until last year by GE Lighting. That's that big historic building. And a Milwaukee company bought it last year. They still put on the lighting display, though, last year along the main road.
So explain that. They've been doing it for almost 100 years, right?
Yes. And this year is number 99, and they'll be lighting up 1 million LEDs on Friday night along Noble Road, showing different holiday scenes, and there'll also be a replica of the 2023 National Christmas Tree with a selfie station.
All right. So obviously we are in Playhouse Square, so what is happening in this area for the holidays?
All right. In this area, just in this theater district, second largest theater district in the country, this is like our Radio City Music Hall, I feel like, at the holidays. There are numerous events every night, but I have to give a nod to Great Lakes Theater. They are doing A Christmas Carol for what turns out to be, I didn't even realize it was this long, 35th year it's happening. And instead of me yammering on and on about it, I'm going to let the producing artistic director, Charles Fee, say a few words.
This year we have a new Ghost of Christmas Present. We have some returning people that haven't been on stage for a couple of years. And, of course, the children in the play generally are different every season. So we have new Tiny Tim. It's always fresh. It is Northeast Ohio's favorite holiday production.
And at the same time, Cleveland Playhouse, which is also based here, they have their annual Festival of Trees and Black Nativity.
Now, I've heard of that. Was that written by Langston Hughes?
Yes, that is the Langston Hughes play written in 1961. And Caramu House is presenting it here for the first half of December. It's kind of a gospel-infused take on the nativity. And if you're looking for actual nativity scenes, there's also a couple which stand out. One is in Akron, the Bethlehem Cave and Nativity Museum.
Here's Kathleen Conrad, who coordinates the tours, to explain how they got so many nativity items.
I think because of the name of the church, our pastor kept getting gifts from people of nativity sets. So he had this little personal collection of nativities. He traveled a lot and he would collect some, and then people would travel and bring them back to him. So he said, let's find a place to put them. And it kind of ballooned.
There's another up in Lake County. It's called the Historic Kirtland Nativity Exhibit, and that's actually at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Now, Kirtland was the home of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and other founders of Mormonism at one time. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know your history, see? There's a lot of structures up there which are still related to Mormonism. You'll be able to see those if you go up as well.
Now, let's get back to theater for a second. This time of year always makes me think of the Nutcracker.
Oh, boy. Okay, so the Nutcracker, of course, me too. I think of that, the music. We all remember the music from Tetris. Shockingly, I could only find productions, get ready, at the Akron Civic Theater, the Canton Palace Theater, and then even Cleveland Ballet is going to still be putting theirs on. All of them have their own productions this month, and actually, if you arrange your calendar just right, you could probably see a few of them, and then even compare and contrast.
The same thing is true for Tuba Christmas, right?
Yeah, that's true. There are several. I always thought, you know, this is the 49th year, and for a long time I always thought there was just one at the University of Akron every year at E.J. Thomas. That's the one I think that most people around here know about. Theirs is actually December 23rd, right before Christmas. But it turns out, if you're in this area, you can't make it to that one, you can see Tuba Christmas, or you can play there in Ashland, Ashtabula, Canton, Lorain, Worcester. And if you check online at our website, ideastream.org, we've got all of them listed there, and you can just show up maybe an hour or two beforehand for rehearsal and be part of the performance if you want.
I love that. And yeah. Fun fact, Kabir,
yes.
You play the tuba.
I do. I can quit at any time, though. I was going to ask, do you play the tuba?
I do not. Is there anything I can do?
There is. Have you ever heard of something called Unsilent Night?
I have not.
Okay. Unsilent Night, this started in New York City in 1992, but stay with me here. So people were given a tape, cassette tape, if you remember those. There was one of four parts of a musical composition, and you were supposed to show up with your boombox, you know, put that on your shoulder, pop the tape in, and then this whole crowd of people with all these different parts of this would walk together as kind of this marching electronic orchestra.
How fun.
Yeah, doesn't that sound? And just I'm just picturing it, all those cool boomboxes in the 90s.
Sure.
But now what that means is that you get the music on your phone. Nobody has boomboxes anymore, and you'll need a lot more people because you're not going to have as many speakers. So get your friends, and you can go check this out. Here's a clip of actually what the original piece of music is supposed to sound like with all four parts blended.
Oh my gosh, that's so fun.
Isn't it? It sounds cool. And, you know, imagine that, but in different states of blend or harmony as you're marching. This was actually written by Phil Klein, who he's from Akron. So now we're going to have one of these here. Yeah, if you want to experience this, Unsilent Night, there's a meetup happening December 8th at the Lincoln Park Gazebo over in Tremont,
and then another one the next night, December 9th, in downtown Kent.
Oh, I love that. So let's hope the weather holds out for that one. I could see people bringing their kids and really enjoying the music.
Absolutely. And if you have one of those new boomboxes with Bluetooth, you could always bring that. But the weather does hold out, there's also going to be some menorah lightings happening in the next few weeks. We've talked a lot about Christmas. Hanukkah starts December 7th, and there's a menorah lighting on Public Square that night. And then 3 days later, there's going to be the Light After Dark Menorah Parade. That ends at Legacy Village. Or if you want an indoor activity, Jewish Akron is hosting Hanukkah at Summit Mall, and that's December 14th.
And what does that involve?
It's been going. This is the 33rd year, and last year's was a very festive event. It's right there in the large food court. There's crafts, there's music, and they light the menorah. And they also had a graffiti menorah created by our friend Mac Love last year, an Akron-based artist.
Are there Kwanzaa events in Northeast Ohio as well?
Yes, because Kwanzaa runs December 26th to January 1st, and the African American Archives Auxiliary of the Western Reserve Historical Society holds its annual Kwanzaa celebration on December 26th. Last year it was at the Historical Society. This year it's going to be nearby at Forest Hills Church in Cleveland Heights, and they'll have free admission, free parking, and refreshments are free.
And then it's 2024.
Yes. Oh, we need our the noisemakers and stuff. Hey, that was better. I'm going to sample that and just play that on New Year's Eve for the kids.
Pop.
Perfect. If you want to ring in 2024 in a fun way, I have two interesting alternatives to just having people over to watch, you know, that guy on TV. One is from Akron Pride, which is hosting its fourth annual Rainbow Ball at the Akron Civic. I don't know if you've ever been to the Akron Civic for like an event or a party as opposed to a show.
No, I haven't.
Oh, it is because they take over the whole building. It's amazing. I mean, all these nooks and crannies, it is very cool. They're going to have Nina West from RuPaul's Drag Race at that. That's going to be New
Fun.
Year's Eve. Yeah. And then in Chagrin Falls up the road at the popcorn shop downtown, they'll be dropping this giant 220-pound popcorn ball at midnight.
No.
Yeah. You know, like in Times Square, they got the ball.
Sure.
This is the popcorn ball. And at one point, I guess it was stolen, and now they recovered it, remade it, and it's not the biggest in the world, but of course, it's got to be the biggest in Ohio. That's going to come down at midnight, and they're going to spray smaller popcorn balls at the crowd in place of confetti.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
And if you can't make it there on New Year's Eve to see the popcorn ball, you can go check it out just to see it on display from December 15th to the 29th.
Well, you better have fun at one of those events. IdeaStream Public Media Senior Arts Producer Kabir Bhatia with plenty of things to do on your holiday to-do list. Thanks so much for swinging by.
Thanks for having me.
All right, a little James Brown to close out the show with some popcorn. Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideascream.org. We're on Twitter at Sound of Ideas, and you can follow me at JennyHamill_. Tomorrow on the Sound of Ideas, we'll talk to IdeaStream's Matt Richmond, who took a close look at the past few years of Cleveland's gunfire detection technology, including ShotSpotter. His reporting asks, are residents safer? And we'll preview a City Club conversation on food justice in Cleveland. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online, or you can listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening. We'll speak with you again tomorrow.